Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Monday, everyone. Welcome to Help for HD Live. This is Melissa Biliardi, your host, and tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 or 877-497-4103. Tonight, we start a new season with new guests, some old, good old friends coming back to the show. Not old, but great friends, like our highly esteemed guest, Dr. Mary Edmondson, and also her sister. Mary's sister is Ann Lassiter, and they are from HD Reach in North Carolina. And Dr. Mary Edmondson and her sister Ann in North Carolina, Mary is the founder of HD Reach, and their group has been problem-solving about what prevents HD communities from accessing care for their families in North Carolina. We're going to be talking about that tonight. That's very interesting, amazing work that they're doing in North Carolina. Their motto, and I love this motto, access to care for all. I love that. Hello, Mary and Ann. It's great to have you both on the show together. How are you?
Great. Good. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So
we're like echoes, right? We're echoes. One of us says the exact same thing as the other person does.
That's great. I wish I could work with my sister like that. That would be awesome. Well, so we have an outline of questions, so we'll go ahead and start with that. So, Anne, how are you two connected to Huntington's disease? I'm sure a lot of people are interested in hearing about that.
Yeah, our father had Huntington's disease. His mother had Huntington's disease, and Mary and I were both preteens when our father was first starting to show some symptoms, and he was diagnosed in 1980. We are the last of six children, the last two. I guess Mom and Daddy saved the best for last. maybe my
Obviously.
Brothers wouldn't say that, but we are the last two of the six of us, and our brothers are a decent amount older than we are, and so Mary and I were pretty much kids when Daddy started getting sick, and so we were moving around the country and kind of dealing with some of the symptoms that we didn't have any clue what was really going on. We just knew we were moving a lot, and Daddy was getting different jobs and those kinds of things. And so one of the things that happened as a result of that is that we kind of pulled pretty close together as kids because we kept moving a lot. And we learned how to deal with Huntington's disease as children. And there was a lot of misinformation at that point in time. You know, we didn't know whether it was sex-linked or whether just men got it or just women got it, or it was only passed down through the mom. Or there was not a lot of information back then. And so we both kind of stuck together and talked a lot about it, but we didn't have a lot of information. Mary is just a smidge older than I am, and we ended up in college at the same time, and we took fairly divergent paths once we started getting into our professional lives. And Mary clearly has a medical degree and went to med school, and I went on to get a degree in education, special education, as a matter of fact. And so Mary went off to medicine, and I went on to education. And so we both took our approach to HD in relatively different ways, but that tie of, you know, HD families being special was a big part of that. Mary, do you have anything to add to that?
Not really, except that I think the one thing that that wasn't as clear is that our brothers did not do all this moving with us. So we were a family of eight when we were real little kids. And then when we were like teenagers and pre-teenagers, my brothers were all in college, and so it was just Ann and I and Mom and Dad. And Mom went back to work, and Dad had lots of trouble getting a job, and our whole entire family structure changed. And Ann and I had to do things that, you know, a lot of kids don't have to do earlier in our life. So I think we learned how to be responsible. And we learned I mean, we'd already learned how to work hard, but I think it took on a new meaning when Dad got sick, and so it was really a huge family adjustment for us, both because Anne and I saw a stage of Dad's disease that our brothers didn't, and when our brothers would come home or we would all get together, the way that Mom and Anne and I handled Dad was a little different than the way the guys handled Dad. And so there were, you know, around the time of his diagnosis, there were a lot of sparks that went flying, to say the least. But, you know, and it was really that first, you know, that first year when, like, everybody realized what truly was going on. And it was during that period of time that I think our family was in the greatest turmoil. And, you know, I see that happen all the time in families now. And to me, it's just it's a pattern that people go through, a year of adjustment when they first figure it out. But, boy, in the middle of it, it sure seems sometimes like you're in a tornado or a hurricane. So, but
yeah.
On the other side of that, we all became much closer. I think our family became much closer, as much because of Huntington's disease. I mean, we all found our way back together. So,
yeah, I think one of the really interesting things about this whole thing was, you know, my father was a soldier during World War II, they had the very traditional, Mom and Daddy had the very traditional marriage, you know, and Mom stayed at home for 25 years until Daddy started to get sick. She was she had a degree, and so she was a woman of the 40s with a degree that she got in 4 years in nutrition and education, promptly started to have 6 children. She also did an internship when she was a young woman at Johns Hopkins. So she was quite well educated, but 25 years she laid out of the workforce. And then when Daddy started to get sick, she went back to work. Whole different world, totally different world for her. And I remember having to show her how to blacken in the ovals for computerized testing. But what an accomplishment. That she probably would not have done had she not had to kind of support the family at the time, but really pretty amazing to watch her go back to work. And she ultimately became re-registered after 25 years of being out of the workforce at a time when, you know, it was not common for women to do that. So it was pretty, it really painted a good path, I think, for what Mary and I could do from a professional career perspective. And yet she still cared for Daddy, and it was tough, no doubt about it, but she did what she had to do. Very resilient woman, my mom.
She was a really great role model to you.
Absolutely, absolutely, no doubt about it.
I was just going to ask you about that. So, Mary, you are one of the founders of HD Reach, and so how did HD Reach come about?
Well, One of the experiences that our family had, my dad was sick through. We moved to North Carolina in 1977, and he died in 1995. And during that period of time, there was literally one person in the state of North Carolina who knew anything about Huntington's disease, and he was at Wake Forest. He was not anywhere close to us, and we didn't know who he was. So we went through a lot of struggles trying to find medical care for my dad and good information for us. So, you know, I did a lot of reading. I asked a lot of questions. You know, I learned a whole lot about the medical profession in doing that, and, you know, pretty much came to the conclusion that, you know, this was really bad disease. It wasn't going to be something I thought was going to get fixed in my lifetime, and I was going to have to go look at other diseases parallel to Huntington's to try and figure out how to take care of my dad. And so when I finished my training and I moved back to Raleigh, my dad had, you know, moderately advanced Huntington's. He was still on his feet and able to get out of the house and so forth, but he you know, he took one trip, maybe two, to Winston-Salem to see Francis Walker. But besides that, he got all his care at home. And when I moved home, it was for me, you know, mm-hmm. which is against every ethical tenet in medicine. But anybody that knows anything about advanced Huntington's knows how incredibly difficult it is to get people to doctor's offices, even if they are somebody who knows something about Huntington's. So I would go over to his house with my stethoscope, and I'd listen to his lungs and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I learned a lot. I learned a whole lot from my mother. I learned a whole lot from a woman who helped us take care of my dad. And when he, you know, when he passed away, I thought, okay, well, things are clearly going to get better. I don't know how they're going to get better, but they're not, you know, our experience is not going to get repeated. So I originally trained as an internist, and I went back and did a second residency in psychiatry. And when I got out, I wanted to sort of take a little time and recover my family because I had little kids. And so I started a support group for Huntington's families. I just wanted to do something. And so I listened to stories of people who came in and met a really sweet, lady who was wrote all the thank you notes for the North Carolina chapter, and she and her family went to all the events and so forth. And then she started to kind of get sicker, and her sisters would come to support group and talk about the different stuff that was happening to her. And mm-hmm. And she became real perseverative and ended up needing a psychiatric hospitalization, which was probably one of the biggest traumas of her life. You know, she was in there for 10 days. They released her too early. She was still, psychotic. I don't know for certain. I don't know exactly what it was because I wasn't looking after her in the hospital. But all I know is that when she went home, she was still sick, and her family put together this little makeshift psychiatric unit with some of the men from their church and took care of her while they waited for her meds to kick in, which I just thought was a testament to how incredibly resourceful people can be, but also what tremendous demands are placed on people who have HD when they have, you know, serious psychiatric symptoms. So anyway, I felt really bad about that because I couldn't really help very much. And then she had colon cancer, had her colon resected. Then they put her into a long-term nursing facility. And her sisters called me and they said, could you please go see her? We're really worried about some of the behaviors that she's got. So, you know, I was pretty fresh out of my residency. And the difference between my first residency and my second residency was the first residency I got out and I thought everything. I thought I was a great internist, and I got out of my, but I, you know, I'd been around long enough to know that's not the case. I mean, I got out of my second residency, so I was a little bit more humble, and I went to go see her, and, you know, I tried everything I could think of, and I thought, certainly there's somebody out there who could do a better job with this than me, because I, you know, I was really new at taking care of Huntington's patients, and I didn't know a lot of the people that I know now who I would have called at that time if I'd had the opportunity. But anyway, so I tried all these different drugs, and nothing worked, and nothing worked, and nothing worked. And I finally just threw my hands up one day, and I said, I'm just going to be an internist and order blood work and see if I'm missing something, because, you know, I've done everything I know how to do, and I just have to make sure there's not some medical issue that I'm not addressing. And later on that afternoon, I got a phone call from the physician at the nursing home who cursed me out for ordering blood work on somebody who was terminally ill, who it wouldn't have mattered what I would have found. It wouldn't have been treated. Which I was horrified by that. I just couldn't believe it. And anyway, her blood work did come back abnormal. And she had some, like, liver chemistry abnormalities and calcium abnormalities and that kind of stuff. And it ended up that she had metastatic colon cancer in her spine.
Oh,
and 2 weeks later, she died in hospice. And I felt so horrible because I'd known her the whole time. She was this incredibly sweet woman. You know, I should have known what to do, but I didn't. And I had absolutely no influence on this guy in the nursing home. And I thought, you know, even though I suppose, to know more than other people do about this. And I, even at that stage in my career, I knew a whole lot more than the vast majority of people did. But it didn't seem to have any impact for her. She still had a miserable time of it. And I thought, you know, 30 years after my dad gets sick, and healthcare is no different. And I just, you know, I just sort of looked in the mirror and I said, you know, you've got these skills, and you know how to do something to make a difference for people. And, you know, if you don't do it, who's going to do it? So, you know, the first thing I realized was that you can't do it by yourself. I can't, one person can't take care of people with HD. It's just, you just need a team of people. So, and I got together with some other folks around the state who had expertise in taking care of people with Huntington's disease. And instead of in a room, we looked around at each other and we said, you know, we've got the team here, not all at one place like you would expect at a center of excellence, but across the state we've got everybody that we need. So why don't we all team up and share our resources and our abilities, and as a team we'll take care of the people around the state. And so since we weren't going to do that at a single institution, and we knew we had to hire a social worker, we decided it had to be an organization outside of the tertiary care centers. You know, it just wasn't going to be, well, for one thing, not all the people in the state of North Carolina go see the people at tertiary care centers. A huge number of people don't go to tertiary care centers, and they're out in Rock Hill, North Carolina, up in the mountains, or they're way out on the coast, and they can't make a trip. Yeah, nor can people with advanced Huntington's make it there. So we just decided that we would create an independent organization that would serve both tertiary care centers as well as patients in the community, and be available to assist their care providers by providing them with information and consultation, or in whatever way we could help people. So that's how HD Reach was born.
Katie, can you ask the next question for me? I've got to put you on hold just for a second. Katie? Sorry, you guys. I have somebody coming up to my door. Katie, are you there? Okay, she's not. She's not there. We'll just have to listen to noise. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
So I guess Anne can probably take it from here about what makes HD Reach different compared to other organizations.
Sure. So, you know, the story that Mary told about her patient, you know, is one of many stories that we've come across. And our mission is to provide access to health care, education, and social assistance, because we really want to help HD patients and their families live well with the disease. So we've had, you know, over 725 clients over time, and we've reached a lot of folks. We still have more to reach. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Kevin and Julie. They were college sweethearts that fell in love, and you know, they had two lovely children and had just this perfect life. And Julie was a professional person. Kevin was as well. They were at the height of their careers, and you know, Julie started kind of falling back behind in work and missing deadlines and having some issues, and in fact her boss had brought it up to her a couple of times, and the more that happened, the more stressed she got, and things, you know, just went from a little stressed to a lot of stress with some outbursts at work and those kinds of things. Well, Kevin and Julie decided that maybe she should take a day off, get kind of caught up with things at work or from work, and, you know, stay home for the day and get caught up with things at home. And Julie said, you know, this is going to be just the ticket for me. It's going to all work out really great. I'm going to catch up. Everything's going to come together, and I'm going to work on some photographs that I've been working on and organizing albums and things like that. And so Kevin thought, you know, gosh, she's been having a hard time of it, and I really am so thrilled that she's got this time to kind of catch up and rejuvenate and revamp. Anyway, she was thrilled. He was excited. Kevin came home from work that night, and there was Julie sitting in the middle of the floor with all the photo albums, you know, in, scattered around, and she's crying and upset because she can't seem to get anything done. The kids are kind of holed up in their rooms, mm-hmm. and, you know, Kevin's sitting there thinking, gosh, this is not the woman that I married. I love her desperately, but something's not right. So they decided to go to the doctor, and through a, you know, the circuitous route that so many people take, you know, ended up at a neurologist's office who did some family history and noticed some of the movements and things, and basically did some blood work and brought him in and said, gee, Julie, I'm really sorry to tell you this, but you have Huntington's disease. It's genetic. Your kids have a 50-50 chance. It's terminal. You probably need to, you know, figure out what you're going to do. Come back and see me in 6 months. Really tough diagnosis to get. Mm. And, you know, that's not an, you know, it's a tough diagnosis, and it's hard to communicate that. And you know, that was a tough day for them. Well, the good news was that they got online and they started looking around and they found HD Reach. They were in North Carolina and they found HD Reach and they called us and talked with Jared Husketh, our director of clinical services, who said, you know what, in 2 days we're having a support group. Why don't you come? Mm-hmm. And so they came to the support group, and you know, they learned a lot from the folks that were there. They were welcomed by everybody. We got them into, you know, we told them about the Center of Excellence over in Durham at Duke, and got them in to see Dr. Scott there, and started showing them some of the resources and things that they can do to help solve some of the problems that they were being faced with. And so things started to get better. She was able to get some medication that helped her work for a little bit longer. I think the great thing about it is that they come to the support groups. They're connected. They have the support to help them live well with the disease. They know that people aren't judging them in those support groups, and we're helping everybody get what they need based on whether they're a caregiver, whether they have HD, or whether they have children that they're worried about. And that's really what we do differently, is that we help get access to care, but we take a problem-solving approach to it to help remove those barriers to care, the things that keep them from accessing the care that they need for their families. So, you know, they're living well with Huntington's and trying to be proactive about the next step in the disease for them. So they've been really happy with, you know, as happy as you can be trying to manage the challenges faced by HD.
What do you feel are some of the biggest obstacles or problems that people need help with?
Well, it's a small population, so there's not a ton of folks out there that are like them. So what we've done is we've looked at the barriers across the state of North Carolina. And North Carolina doesn't always look like it's a big state, but it's like 500 miles from the mountains to the ocean. It's a great state because we have mountains and ocean, but it's a long way between the two. And so what we try and do to provide access to care is to get out into those communities. So we have support groups in Charlotte, Winston-Salem, and Raleigh. That's kind of the center part of the state, and our goal is to expand even further. We're available by phone. We try and find resources and solutions to problems that are within a reasonable distance for the HD community. As Mary mentioned, it's tough to get across the state to go see somebody. Mm-hmm. So we work really hard with a whole variety of providers and organizations across the state to try and make sure that folks have access to the care that they need.
That's a big problem that we have in California, too, because it's such a long state, you know.
Yeah, it's tough.
Hard.
It is tough. We really try and get out and interact with the providers. We've got great relationships at Wake Forest and Duke, and we work really hard to make sure we have great relationships there and to find out what resources people need and target and make sure that they have choices when they have specific issues that they're trying to resolve. We have actually three great resources. It's UNC is also a good partner of ours in Chapel Hill. So we have, you know, some really great resources, but they don't, each one doesn't do it all. So we kind of work together with all of those three, or at least help folks see what each of those three different organizations do best.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the way we look at it is we're kind of the hub that connects them all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's hard to find all those individual resources if you're having to, you know, as we used to say when the Yellow Pages were around, let your fingers do the walking, but you're walking across mm-hmm. the Internet and there's so many choices. So we really try and help make it easier for folks to get the care that they need.
Do some of your patients there in North Carolina go to the different providers to get different services, or do they pretty much just stick to one?
Most of them are seeing one neurologist, but there's, you know, it's multidisciplinary care. So a lot of what we do is we do care management. So we know, for example, that any given HD patient may need a neurologist, a psychiatrist, a therapist, a physical therapist, an occupational therapist. So we help them kind of, you know, find out those folks who might have some experience and are good with the HD community, and connect them as best we can to make sure that, you know, they're not trying to figure out, you know, who do I go to, and we do that with everything from that to even helping them get connected with folks that can help them with Social Security disability.
Mm-hmm. So the social workers are at these different providers, basically?
So Jared is actually part of our organization and the
okay,
folks that run
so
the support groups.
Facilitates.
Yeah, they facilitate.
Okay.
They facilitate
Jared.
This. Yay, Jared, yes.
He
Yay,
sounds
Jared.
Like a very valuable person to have on your staff.
Yes. And we have some folks that are in, you know, Winston-Salem and elsewhere that are doing similar types of work. Jared kind of runs the show as it relates to that, though.
Yay. Well, that's great.
Yeah, it's a big job. Let me just put it that way.
Do we know how many HD families are in North Carolina?
Yeah, there are about 1,000 people in North Carolina that have Huntington's disease, and
mm-hmm.
we estimate that there are another 5,000 that are at risk.
Wow,
that's a pretty big number, and you know if you're in, you know, way over on the East Coast, it's, you know, a 3 or 4 hour drive to get to the Triangle. If you're in the mountains, it's tough getting down those mountains sometimes, and it's just not easy to get there. And so a lot of folks live in silence with Huntington's disease, and they don't get the care that can help them live a better life.
So how are you going to address that need? Are you going to try to get something on wheels for those people? Or how?
Well, we're this year we're going to be expanding into Eastern North Carolina. So our goal is to try and get a support group or a social worker in a region so that folks don't have to travel so far. And that they can at least have somebody by phone that's easily accessible to them to help them figure out where do I go. And part of that is to get to know the providers in that part of the state that might mm-hmm. be able to help them. So to foster the relationship with the community and help to educate the community and the providers about what Huntington's disease is and how they might be able to help and connect the healthcare community with these centers of excellence and these centers in the state of North Carolina that they can call to get some advice and counsel on. And you'll not find, you know, anybody any better than these docs that are working on this. They really want to help this community, and so it's really they're always willing to, you know, help others learn about it. And that's something we are truly committed to doing, is to continually learn and improve from all the professionals, but to also look to the community to help identify what those needs of the HD community are, and to provide caregiver tips and ways to live if you are trying to decide whether you're going to get tested or not, or, you know, just the whole range of concerns that an HD family would have.
Well, you all have the model program that I think could be implemented in other states, and you're so fortunate to have each other as sisters working together. But, Dr. Mary Edmondson has been such a highly esteemed physician and psychiatrist in the community for so long. And now you, with your education and communications background, what a perfect team, you know?
Well, as long as, you know, we stay out of the, you know, our, as long as we don't cross the room line, don't touch each other, we're fine. Don't
I
touch
love
me.
It.
I won't say that we don't have strong opinions, but we are pretty much, but we fight fair. If there, you know,
yeah.
We do. We disagree respectfully with each other, and there are.
Keep it spicy,
no, I mean,
you know?
That's the truth. We have very, very different backgrounds, and I actually think Anne's background in education, I mean, I have learned so much about coaching and leadership structures and the operational way of helping somebody change their behavior. So, like, I know how to, like, recommend that people change their behavior, but Anne has a different sort of operational way of mm-hmm. helping somebody learn how to do something quicker, faster, and also not rescue them
right.
from their errors,
mm-hmm.
Which is it's a great thing to see, and I think it's going to be a big benefit to the Huntington's community once we get her to the point where she can actually start developing some educational modules for caregivers. I think that'll be, once we get her so that we're working on all, you know, eight cylinders, it's been a big change in our organization to bring Anne in, and she's had a fair amount of work just to get the office organized.
Well, you're having growing pains, probably, like we are.
Yeah.
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 But it's
well,
a good thing, right?
And I think that there's so much happening, and it's so exciting to be a part of this and to really see families come to us and for us to, you know, help take some of the burden from them by getting them connected with the people who can really make a difference for them. And that's thrilling. And so, you know, the combination of, you know, Mary's years of experience in the medical background that she knows and her understanding of the psychosocial issues associated with Huntington's makes it really ripe for being able to make some pretty good some good difference in the HD family's life. Doesn't take away the fact that the disease is still there, and we're still counting on those researchers and, you know, medical professionals to keep plugging away to find a cure. But in the meantime, you know, we're learning how we can actually live better with the disease as opposed to just saying, oh, isn't this horrible? 'Cause it is, but we can do that. We can make it better.
Right. So let's talk about HD families and how can how can they be proactive in managing the disease?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that was a challenge for our family, and I think it's a challenge for many families, is, you know, gosh, I don't even want to think about this. And denial is a certain aspect of it. But what we found personally, and I've seen in families as they've tried to, you know, work through some of this, is that if they're taking a problem-solving approach and a proactive approach to it, things actually start to get better. So that would be one of the first things, I think, is to say, well, what are we going to do about it, and how are we going to manage this, and how are we going to, you know, what are the things that we can do to solve this problem? And one of the things I've learned from Mary based on, you know, watching her is, you know, if something's happening with a person who has HD that seems out of sorts and not quite right, you know, to look at the whole person and not just one piece of it. So maybe they're sick. Maybe they're like really, you know, like have a cold or a sinus infection in addition to all the other things that it might be. So looking at it from a problem-solving approach, I think really helps take all that into consideration.
Right. Well, I think all HD families just want to know that there's somebody out there that can help them, you know, whether it's, you know, talking to them and advising them of what care to pursue or needing social services or just somebody to understand what they're going through, you know, with support groups and one-on-one phone calls and things like that.
Yep. I totally agree. One of the other things I've learned is that HD has treatable symptoms, and you can do some things around some of the symptoms. You need to engage the right healthcare providers to be able to do that. But there are treatable symptoms, and engaging that physician and the other healthcare providers will really help with that. Mary, right. Do you have anything you want to add about that? Because that's really your bailiwick.
You mean about treatment, about the benefits of treatment? Well, let me give you a parallel, like a comparison. So if you think about people that have diabetes, if people aren't screened and you just wait until somebody gets symptoms, what they do is they come in thirsty, peeing constantly, and that's because their sugars are up. And they can eventually get dehydrated and sicker and sicker and so forth. And, you know, there's not anybody that wouldn't do something to try and drop that individual blood sugar, mostly just to manage those acute symptoms, but also because if you lower somebody's blood sugar over the long haul, right, you're going to prevent complications like vascular disease and eye disease and so forth. And no one's ever really kind of looked at Huntington's that way. That is, that it's a chronic disease that has symptoms directly related to the disorder, and so you'd like to relieve those symptoms. But in addition to that, are there things that we think of as symptoms of Huntington's that actually might be complications? For example, if somebody gets depressed and they're not treated, there's a chance that they will become suicidal. However, if you treat someone who's got depression, you know, aggressively, they may never get suicidal. So is suicide a symptom of Huntington's or a complication of Huntington's? And the same thing with aggression.
That's a good point.
And, you know, other things. So the way that I look at it is that there are acute symptoms that if you reduce those, people suffer less. And then there are symptoms that you reduce because you're preventing other bad things from happening. Mm-hmm. And there was a paper that was released, I don't know, a couple years ago about the incidence of violence in Huntington's. And the numbers were pretty alarming. Of course, it depends upon what you describe as aggression. But, if you know, because there's verbal aggression and then there's physical aggression and towards objects and physical aggression towards other people. So, you know, it's not like the 70%-ish numbers that they published that, you know, there's like a lot of damage done with each of those episodes of violence. But you add them up over time. If someone's untreated and their family's not taught how to de-escalate situations or how not to aggravate the situation. And, you know, you add that stuff over time and people, you know, come to the conclusion that Huntington's equals violence.
Right.
When, in fact, it's a consequence of untreated symptoms more
right.
so than it is that people with Huntington's have this massive personality change and become violent people. It's just that's not what HD is. And
okay.
so
But that
so
does
the,
happen.
The way that it does happen, but
it
it's
does
more
happen,
common
yeah.
that there's precursor things that happen that lead up to that. So my point is that we need to start thinking about Huntington's like a chronic disease. It lasts 20 to 35 years if you look at the entire course from the very early onset of cognitive symptoms to, you know, across a lifespan. And so I think that, you know, we really have a lot of work to do to figure out what's the right treatment, like, you know, what has the greatest impact on quality of life. Because we don't know that yet in Huntington's, but we certainly do know how to reduce symptoms and mm-hmm. how to counsel somebody about the risks and benefits, the side effects and the benefits of different medications that someone might choose to take, and negotiate with that person around what are the things that are most important to them and their family until you find a treatment. And just like the lady that I talked about earlier, I'm pretty convinced that the reason she had such resistant symptoms were because it was the only way she could communicate her pain.
Mm.
I don't, you know, that was the only way she could say, I'm in pain, I'm in pain, I'm in pain.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she had limited language and mm-hmm. you know, it's hard to express that when you've already got communication barriers and, you know, on top of her physical barriers. So,
well, and if you're in pain for long periods of time, it just wears you down.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
it
absolutely.
Does.
Mm.
So,
well,
in
do you think
mind,
early diagnosis is important to stay on top of treating symptoms, maybe?
So everybody makes a decision about when they want to find out that they have Huntington's. But if you want to think about, so I talked about Huntington's as a chronic disease, so I'm just going to talk about the word disease. Somebody has a disease when they have symptoms that limit their function, that it mm-hmm. limits their ability to live the life they want, whether it's being able to live to their greatest potential and perform in a, you know, very demanding job, or they have symptoms that make them miserable and they're less capable of interacting with the people that they love well, or, you know, there are consequences within the family, so some kids not doing as well academically as they could. So the question is, at what point do Huntington's symptoms, whether you want to call it motor manifest Huntington's disease, at what point do people have symptoms that impair their function if they're not treated?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we do have more data about that now. We do mm-hmm. do know that people have onset of psychiatric and cognitive symptoms 7 to 15 years before motor onset. So there are people that are walking around out there who think that you can only be diagnosed with Huntington's if you have chorea, when in fact there are treatable symptoms many, many years, as much as a decade or more before then. You know, it's one of the rare privileges of my job that every once in a while somebody will come and we will spend time preparing them. You know, it'll be relatively obvious to me that somebody has symptoms of Huntington's, and they've come to ask that question, so we spend a lot of time talking and getting prepared for that information. And the day that they come and, you know, and they're walking out of my office, just me having told them that they have Huntington's disease, and they say, oh, wow, I feel so much better. I feel
mm-hmm.
so much better now. And so I think that there is benefit to reducing uncertainty. I think there's benefit to treating symptoms before they cause functional loss, and I personally think there's a benefit to coping with the knowledge of the disease when you're in good shape cognitively.
Mm-hmm.
Because if, for example, if, let me just say that, let me give you an example. Let's say that somebody has baggage, whatever it might be in their life, and but they don't pursue mental health care because they're pretty convinced somebody's going to tell them they have Huntington's disease. That was me.
Right.
So you just gather baggage, and then, you know, you end up waiting until you got motor signs of Huntington's, when you're by that point you've had, you know, years of some number of years possibly with cognitive decline and psychiatric symptoms. So you're not going to be in your best place to cope with your baggage at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, your baggage is different than Huntington's disease, right? It's the grief over the parent that you lost. It's the,
right,
the grief over your some aspects of your childhood that you lost. It's you know, there's lots of griefs in life, and, mm-hmm, and some of them are a direct consequence of HD. And some of those create perceptions in your mind or perceptions about Huntington's disease that aren't true. And so addressing those when you're cognitively intact,
mm-hmm,
makes, I think, actually living with Huntington's for yourself and your family easier.
And that's where education comes in, right? The more we educate,
yeah,
the better.
Yeah.
Excellent,
yeah,
information. What a wonderful show this has been. Thank you so much. Anne, it's so wonderful to have you working with Mary now.
And, it's great.
We'll really be looking forward to hearing how everything goes and how your education day, you have your education day on April 2nd. I've put up your links, your web links in the chat room here on the show, and I'll put it on the event page for everyone who's gone to come to the event, the radio,
great,
show event. We'll just make sure that everybody knows what you're doing. You want to talk about your education day real quick?
Sure, I'd love to. So our education day is April the 2nd. It's going to be in Greensboro, North Carolina, on the campus of UNC Greensboro. And we have a full day. Jimmy Pollard is coming. He's going to talk about Hurry Up and Wait as our keynote speaker. We have Dr. Francis Walker, Dr. Bert Scott, and Mary, who along with some other folks, who will be talking about the latest and greatest in healthcare associated with Huntington's disease. So we're very excited about that. We will have breakout sessions in the afternoon, and those sessions will be a session for caregivers, a session for those who have Huntington's, for those at risk, and we're really excited. We're going to have some sessions for the kids that are living in HD families, so we're really excited about that. Probably the best part of all is that this is with our partners, the North Carolina chapter of HDSA. Kathy Martinek and her crew are hand in hand with us, so we're very excited,
awesome,
to partner with HDSA on this. And we're going to wrap it up with an advocacy thing at the end of the day about how we can go out individually and make a difference in fighting for HD. And so we're very excited to be a partner of HDSA to participate in this. So we're looking
fantastic
for a big crowd. We want a bunch of people there. It's free. and, you know, you can come. We just ask that folks register. It's on our website at www.hdreach.org. And if some folks are having some financial hardship, they can apply for a scholarship to if they're having some trouble getting to the event. So we are super excited about it. Can't wait.
Well, you have a great lineup, and it's going to be at Elliott University Center at UNC Greensboro in Greensboro, North Carolina. And it's going to be on Saturday, April 2nd, and registration will be at 8:30 to 9:30, and the programs will start at 9:30 to 4. There's going to,
mm-hmm,
be a lot of activities. Looks like you're going to have a barbecue lunch buffet, which is yummy.
Yeah.
And now, is there a cost for your education day?
No, it's completely free.
Oh,
food is free, parking is free, everything is free, and we'll even have a little continental breakfast at the beginning. So if you come in around 8:30 and you have a little time to kill, there'll be a continental breakfast as well.
Thank you so much. Well, can you ladies hang out while we do some announcements? I'll have Katie do our announcements, and then we'll close the
sure.
show. And unless there's anything we forgot.
No, I think we're good.
Okay, Katie, take it away.
Thank you, Anne and Mary. What a show. I'm going to talk about some upcoming events we have at Health Reach International. On April 9th, we have our annual symposium in Sacramento, California, and that's at the DoubleTree Hilton in Sacramento. On April 23rd, there's going to be a casino night out for JHD. On May 1st, we're having Jackie's Walk for HD in Glen Island Park, New York. Tentatively in August, we're actually going to have a Battle of the Band concert in Central California. October 8th, we're having another symposium, actually in Tallahassee, Florida. And then we have some upcoming shows on the calendar already. March 2nd at 1 o'clock p.m., this is PST. These are all PST times. We have Dr. LaVonne Goodman, and she's going to start a series called Breaking the Stigma, Let's Talk About Psychiatric Symptoms. So that will be her first episode of that series. March 9th at 1 o'clock, we're going to be talking to Sharon Thomason about a new genetic test that she went through with her son. On March 16th at 1 o'clock p.m., HSG is going to be on talking about all that's going on at HSG. On March 23rd, Amanda Miller is coming on from Iowa. She's a social worker, and she is going to talk about some JHD programs that she has started over there, as well as a law enforcement program. On March 30th at 1 o'clock, we have Teva Pharmaceuticals. On April 6th at 1 o'clock, we have LaVonne Goodman. She's going to do part two of the series of Breaking the Stigma. Let's talk about psychiatric symptoms. And on April 13th at 1 o'clock, we have Lisa Davenport, and she's going to talk about her journey finding her birth mother. She, if anyone has read Life Interrupted, Lisa wrote a very, very amazing, compelling chapter in the book, and her story is just so, she's so strong, and she's such an amazing person. So we are very much looking forward to having her come and tell her story about finding her birth mother. So that's all for now.
Thank you, everyone. We'll conclude the show tonight. Thank you, everyone out there, for listening and for tuning in. Don't forget to send the show link, out to your friends, family, and colleagues. These episodes are also, they're recorded live and archived. You can find them on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio. They're free downloads, and they're just full of great information for your support groups and for your family and friends. So don't forget to do that. Thank you, Mary and Anne, again, for coming on the show. We love you.
Thank you for spending this time with us.
Good night, everyone. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks. Have a great week.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.